I wanted to start off talking about, I guess, a couple of issues, and then respond to questions. I wanted to talk about, first of all, the budget, a little bit about the budget in education and war, and then a little bit about crime policy and respond to questions. And we have, I tell my colleagues not to bother to discuss the budget without charts, because no one will believe what these people have done to the budget in the last 6 years. You have to see the chart. To break the color code, the red is Republican presidents, the blue is Democratic presidents, and you can see that Clinton dug these guys out of a big mess, went up into a surplus, and as soon as this administration came in, I mean, what kind of adjective would you use? Complete collapse, total fiscal recklessness. Whatever adjective you used, if you didn't have a chart to show what you're talking about, they would assume you're just being partisan. So we bring the chart. As a matter of fact, chart number two, when President Bush came in, we had a projected 10-year surplus of $5.5 trillion. Those same 10 years look like they're going to come in now at almost a $3 trillion deficit, $8.5 trillion deterioration in the budget. Now, before they can mumble, we've been at war, what do you expect? $300 billion for the war is $0.3 trillion. $8.5 trillion deterioration, $0.3 attributable rest. They have no excuse for this fiscal recklessness. The next chart shows when you run up a lot of debt, you got to pay interest on the national debt. When this administration came in and we invited Greenspan to testify before all the committees, the questions he had to answer were questions like, when we pay off the national debt in 8 to 12 years, what will happen to the bond market? What will happen to interest rates? Because we were on target to pay off the national debt by 2013, pay off debt held by the public by about 2008, but cover up, put all the money back in the Social Security we'd been borrowed, put all the money in all these other funds about 2013. Zero interest on the national debt. Instead, we're going to be spending in a couple of years $300 billion a year interest on the national debt, just interest. Now, big number, let's put it in perspective. How many people can you hire at $30,000 each with $300 billion? Any math experts in the room? 10 million. And let's put that big number in perspective. How many people are unemployed, drawing unemployment in the United States today? On any given day, it's about 8 or 9 million. You could hire everybody unemployed looking for a job with money left over for interest on the national debt because these people have messed up the budget. And they always say, well, it's always spending. It's not revenues, it's spending. Well, the blue line is spending, and the red line is revenues. You'll notice that the peak of the revenues, right before all the major tax cuts, which collapsed the revenues, incidentally, at the same time, Bush was increasing spending, you see that as a percentage of GDP, we're pretty modest in spending already. The thing that's killing us is the revenues are so low. That little dotted line up there is, if we spent $200 billion for Katrina, what would it do to the long-term budget? Blip on the screen. The difference between the blue line and the red line, the deficit going out, as far as I can see, is a result of the fact that they've done all these tax cuts, and we say it's tax cuts for the rich. Well, they don't like us saying that, but this next chart is a $20 billion a year tax cut. It just went into effect last year. And this is who gets it. For those of you who made $1 million last year, you'll get about an average of about $20,000. For those who only made $500,000 to $1 million, you'll get a couple of thousand, $200,000 to $500,000, you get a few hundred dollars. If all you made was $75,000 to $100,000, you get about 10 cents a month. And under $75,000, it is unlikely that you will receive a dime out of that $20 billion a year tax cut. Now, go to number seven. Now, one of the next one. One of the things about running up debt, we're borrowing the money not from ourselves, but from foreign countries, to a large extent from foreign countries. This is debt held by foreigners, and you can see how that's been going up over the years. The black line is going down to zero, because if we paid off the national debt, we wouldn't owe anybody, much less foreigners and foreign countries. A substantial portion of this is coming from China, Japan, and Saudi Arabia. That is national security and implications. How are you going to negotiate gas prices borrowing money from Saudi Arabia? How are you going to negotiate a trade deal with Japan and China? And if China attacked Taiwan and we went running over there to try to defend Taiwan, we couldn't do it until we borrowed some money from China to finance the operation. I mean, it has all kinds of foreign policy implications. Now, they said they got us in this mess. Go back one. Let's see if we can go back one. Okay. They said they got us in this mess. I mean, they just say stuff. The job market is going great. Heard that? Just put up the chart. In the last couple of months, it has done pretty well, and he's just gotten up to where he is tied. Instead of last place, he is now tied for last place since Herbert Hoover. That's an arithmetic fact. So when they talk about how good the economy is going, tied for last place since Herbert Hoover. I mean, we're just talking about arithmetic. We need another chart up there for the stock market. I'd like to see that because the stock market has reached record heights. If you look at the average growth in the stock market since he's been in office, I'm not sure. I know it's about 10% of what Clinton did to the stock market. I suspect after about 6 years, it's worse. You may be able to go back to Herbert Hoover. Certainly one of the worst in 50 years. So when they talk about how great the stock market is doing since it is finally reaching new heights, we need a chart for that too. But the final chart is one that the students sort of pay attention to. This is the Social Security cash flow. We're now bringing in more Social Security cash than we're paying out. 2017, give or take, we're going to be paying out more than we're bringing in. When you cross the 900 level, that's $900 billion. When you cross about the 12, you get down around 12, that's about what we get from the individual income tax, somewhere between a trillion, 1.2, 1.3 trillion. Is everybody's individual income tax. So you can see how bad that is. And when they talk about a Social Security shortfall, that's what they're talking about. Now, the present value, what we need in the bank today that we don't have, that would allow us to pay Social Security for 75 years, when this administration came in office, that number was about $4 trillion. Now, we'll remember that we had $5.5 trillion surplus projected for the next 10 years. So we had it in the bank, spent it in debt, and now have no way to pay this. The Medicare chart is just about the same, looks just about the same. So when you start talking about what we can do with education and all the other kinds of initiatives, healthcare that we want to do, we look at this and the first chart to show what kind of resources we have. First of all, in education, No Child Left Behind has been underfunded. By now, it's up to about $50 billion. About $15 billion this year alone, underfunded. No Child Left Behind is an accountability thing where you give a lot of tests to find out where the problems are. And it's supposed to have a lot of money so that you can deal with the problems. Well, if you don't have the money, all you've done is find out where the problems are. Now, we have a little analogy what the farmers tell us, and that is that you do not fatten a pig by weighing the pig. You don't improve education by giving the test. Once you've given the test, what you do after that, new resources, smaller class sizes, professional development, new techniques, whatever you do after you find out where the problems are, that's where you're improving education. If you don't put the money up there, then obviously you're limited at what you can do. But No Child Left Behind is $15 billion a year and growing underfunded. We finally, for the first time, in 6 years, increased Pell Grants just a little bit, about $200 on the maximum. Hopefully we'll do another $200 before the year is up. Unfortunately, the president's increase in Pell Grants comes at the expense of student loans, where the we have in the House cut the student loan interest rate in half, and hopefully the Senate will agree. But student loans and lower student loan interest, Pell Grants, are things that are easy to do within this budget if you don't have the kinds of deficits and kinds of interest on the national debt that we're talking about. So education is one of the things we're trying to focus on. Obviously, that has implications for everything else. But for example, crime. I serve as Rodney mentioned, chairman of the crime subcommittee. And crime policy is actually very easy. It's complicated only because you have a threshold question to answer in terms of crime policy, and that is, are you trying to reduce crime or are you trying to play politics? Once you've answered that, if you're trying to reduce crime, we know what to do. If you're trying to play politics, you know what to do. But unfortunately, there are very few things on both lists. You're playing politics, tough on crime, lock them up, throw away the key. That we've been doing that for the last 20 or 30 years. We have more people locked up in the United States proportion to the population than anywhere on earth. And it's not even close. The only thing that's close, we're at 700 and some per 100,000. Next is about 600 per 100,000. There are very few outside of 100 and some per 100,000. China, about 111 per 100,000. Mexico and Canada, about 100 per 100,000. There are few around 50 per 100,000. In jail today, 700 in some inner cities, the number gets 1,500, 1,000, 3,000, 5,000 is not an unusual number to find because we keep locking people up and doing nothing to reduce crime. The kinds of things that actually reduce crime, get a hold of young people early, keep them on the right track from start to finish, prevention and early intervention. Most of those programs save more money than they cost, certainly reduce crime. So once you've decided what you're doing, it's easy. One of the main aspects of good crime policy is a good education. Those who are headed towards college are not the ones involved in violent crime. We know that if you look at the prison population, 2/3 of high school dropouts, a substantial portion can't read or write. So that if we had reduced the number of illiterates, increase the number of those going to college, increase the number of graduates, we would significantly reduce the number of people involved in crime. So one of the things that we're going to try to do is try to shift the focus to lock them up and throw away the key to prevention and early intervention. And this does not mean we're going to let people out. Let's just keep the rate at where it is, 700 and some per 100,000, okay. But if you're going to put some more money into the fight against crime, put it all into prevention and early intervention, and we'll still be the meanest, most highest incarcerator in the world. So you can't accuse anybody of being soft on crime. And finally, the other issue I just want to touch on is the war. The president, I guess the recent news, just insult to injury, where Tony Blair has decided to pull troops out of Iraq right at the same time Bush is trying to escalate the number of people over there. The escalation has got to be put into a context of everything that's been said about the war from start up into where we are now. We were told, for example, that we're going to war because of weapons of mass destruction. Had we waited a few minutes to find out whether they're going to find any or not, because they hadn't found any, we would have found out that there are no weapons of mass destruction, but we knew when we voted on the war that we hadn't found any weapons of mass destruction. We knew for a fact that there was no evidence that Iraq was connected with 9/11. The CIA told us not only were there no terrorist threat to the United States, that if we attacked them, there would be more of a terrorist threat to the United States. We also knew, when people say, if I knew then what I know now, I would have voted different. We also knew that the war was running 70% in the polls. So what do we know now? No weapons of mass destruction, no imminent threat, no connection with 9/11, and it's running 30% in the polls. What were we told as we kept percolating along? We were told, the budget committee was told not even to budget the war. The cost of the war would be so small that they haven't put the cost of the war in the budget, and they also haven't put oil revenues in the budget, and it's essentially not enough to worry about. So don't even put the cost of the war into the budget. We were told that mission had been accomplished and that major fighting in Iraq had ended. We were told that a year and a half ago that the insurgency is in the last throes of the insurgency. And here we are discussing more troops, not less. And we're talking about another, between the supplemental that's around the corner and the regular budget, another $200 billion. Now, at some point, somebody's got to ask, why is this thing costing as much? Even if you're going to go to war, why is it costing this kind of money? Anybody know how much it cost us to beat Iraq 15 years ago, start to finish? Start to finish, it cost us... It was close. It was close. We stopped taking money when we got it down to $7.4 billion. 7.4. Now, if we'd gotten greedy, we could. People were contributing. It wasn't my way or the highway, so people were contributing. Had we gotten greedy, we probably could have covered it and made a profit on it. But we cut it off at $7.4 billion. That was the cost, start to finish. Now, the war cost more than that, but we had allies, $7.4. And this thing is $300 billion, no end in sight, $200 billion already requested, and more, obviously, around the corner. I mean... At what point do people suggest that these people don't know what they're talking about? Now he says, well, let's have some more troops. Let's have a little surge, 20,000. Turns out, I didn't know it until he asked for this additional 20,000 because it didn't make any difference. We've had little surges four times in this war. Nobody's noticed it because it didn't make any difference. 10,000 here, 15,000 there, 8,000... No difference. Why does anybody believe that this 20,000 is going to make a difference, particularly when experts have said if your goal is to stabilize Baghdad, you're talking 100,000 additional troops, not 20. And if somebody says, well, failure is not an option. Okay. If this surge doesn't do anything more than anything else that's gone on so far, 4 and 5 months down the line, 6 months, when you figure out that it hadn't made any difference, failure is no more of an option then as it is now. At what point do you recognize that this is a civil war like the National Intelligence Estimate said it was, and that we're in a mess that there is no success around the corner? Now, they have been successful in bullying people. Anybody that doesn't agree with them is on the barrel end of political assaults. They picked up a Senate seat in Georgia when Max Cleland was subjected to a TV ad. Here you have a guy in a wheelchair, lost three limbs in the war, subjected to a TV ad that puts him and Osama bin Laden in the same frame. It's all been almost don't worry, be happy, success is around the corner, and if you don't believe it, you're not patriotic, and you're not supporting the troops. Well, I think at the last election, thanks to the Young Democrats and many others, people finally got to the idea that you can be patriotic and you can support the troops and you can criticize a policy that doesn't look like it's making any sense. And that's where we are now. We passed a resolution last week, which is a technically non-binding resolution. People say, why waste time with a non-binding resolution? I think that was absolutely the right thing to do because it gives everybody the opportunity to tell the president that this thing isn't working. It's time to bring the troops home. Let's sit down and work out a strategy that makes the most sense, but the direction ought to be coming home, not sending more over there, and we can work out a nice strategy. The legislative branch cannot effectively be commander-in-chief. You don't need I mean, you actually needed some more troops over there, you can't wait for a committee hearing and a committee vote and a conference committee between the House and the Senate and possibly have a filibuster in the Senate all while you need the troops over there. You cannot effectively run this thing from the legislative branch. So the technically non-binding resolution gave us the opportunity to tell the president that Congress does not support this action. We need to sit down, work out a strategy to bring the troops home. Unfortunately, all we've gotten from the other side is cut off the funds or shut up. That puts us in a situation where if we cut off the funds, that would create a mess. We would have to decide whether the mess that is created by precipitously just cutting off the funds is more of a mess than we're in now. That's going to be a close call. We would like them, like the president, to sit down with us and work out an intelligent strategy to bring the troops home. And if we are forced into a cut off the funds or shut up, who knows what might happen. That's where we are right now. Perhaps the president or the Republicans will get together and we can work something out. I think so long as the president sees the kind of support that he showed within the Republican Party opposing the resolution that just said we support the troops and we oppose an escalation at this time, 90% of the Republicans voted with him, 180-some. He needs 140-some to sustain a veto. So legislative options are obviously limited because anything we do affirmatively, he can veto, which pretty much limits us to cut off the funds or shut up if that's where we're going to be. That's a tough spot to put us in. I don't know where the votes would come. Hopefully we'll just delay the money a little bit and said, well, you know, you get your money when you come and talk, and maybe we can use it as a leverage to force some discussion. But there's not much discussion now other than the decider has decided, and that's where we are. Anyway, that's a couple of issues that I wanted to touch on. But I look forward to questions that you may have, and if anyone has a question, now's the time. But thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you today.
Does anyone have any questions for Congressman Scott?
Yes, sir. It's hard to tell right now. There is significant support for doing something about health care. We haven't seen this kind of national interest in health care since 1992-93. In 93, I was on the floor of the House of Representatives when President Clinton said to send him a bill that covers everybody or reach in his pocket, pull out a pen, or I'm going to use this pen to veto the bill. I was one of the many on our side that stood up and cheered that statement. What we should have done is sat down and then worked out, counted the votes, and see what we had 218 votes for and cover them. We had 150 votes, probably 125 to 150 for a straight-up single-payer plan. You had 100 and 200 and some votes for significant improvement. You had all different kinds of plans out there. You didn't have 218 for any of them to cover everybody. I think we could have, particularly since we were doing welfare reform at the same time, I think we could have done all children. Could have had a substantial increase in Medicaid to cover people, not only poor children, but almost upper middle class. And if you're going that far, you might as well just cover all children. You got senior citizens, everybody covered under Medicare. Children, everybody covered under Medicaid. I think that was possible. But we went for everything or nothing, ended up with nothing. I would hope that rather than fixate on a single payer plan, which I believe is the only thing that ultimately makes sense, we ought to figure out what we can do to make a substantial improvement in coverage. I think we can cover virtually all children. I think we have the will and the political muscle to do that. My sense is we ought to lock that in and then get to arguing about the next step rather than trying to do too much all at one time. Children through SCHIP, Virginia has gotten over 90% covered right now. And I think they're working on the other 6, 8, 10%. Significant improvement in SCHIP, I think, is probably where we're going to end up this year, where we'll cover kids up to about, in families, up to about $30,000 or $40,000, maybe $50,000. At that point, most of the others have employer coverage. Ultimately, single payer is the only place you can be, and I think that's where we've got to start off. I think the problem in 93, Hillary Clinton's plan was so busy trying to incorporate the private insurance companies, who it turned out stabbed her in the back with the Harry and Louise ads, but she was so busy trying to incorporate the private sector that you had a monstrosity that nobody could understand, not unlike the prescriptive drug benefit. Hopefully we can get to a single payer plan, but short term, I think SCHIP to cover all children would be the next step we're going to take.
Mm-hmm. Born in 1986, so I'm looking at that chart, and I'll be 51 years old at the end of that chart. And I guess 15 years after that, people like me, born the same year as me, will start looking at Social Security. Is there a way to save it?
We could pay 75 years. How old will we be in 75 years? 90-some? If we had taken the $5.5 trillion surplus we had in 2001 and put it in a Social Security lockbox. I mean, you hadn't heard lockbox since after Al Gore got defeated. We're running this little surplus. We're spending it. That's part of the, I mean, we spend that and win this little deficit chart and then begin going in deficit. If you did an on budget chart where you did not include the $100 billion or so we're getting in Social Security, all these lines would be about $100 billion lower in the first chart. But it's doable. You got to get the budget under control. You got to start running surpluses again. And you can't do that so long as your first order of business is massive tax cuts. Now, one of the things that we're going to run into is PAYGO. PAYGO is pay-as-you-go. Put the first chart up. Is pay-as-you-go. During the, on the first chart, you see where we dug ourselves out of the hole. We had a process called PAYGO. If you come up with a new plan, new spending plan, you have to concurrently come up with enough taxes to pay for it or spending cuts to pay for it. Got to pay-as-you-go. If you want to cut somebody's taxes, you can cut their taxes, but you got to raise somebody else's taxes or cut programs in the same proposal, you got to pay for it. And so what you ended up with is somebody coming up with an idea, I got a nice plan, and here's how I'm going to pay for it. And you say, well, I like the plan, but I don't want to pay those taxes. Okay, can't do anything. Here's a nice tax cut, and here are the programs we're going to cut to pay for it. Well, no, those are important programs. They're not going to have the tax cut. When the Republicans came in, they let PAYGO expire. So when they had these massive tax cuts, the question was, how would you like a tax cut? And the answer was, I believe I would like a tax cut. How would you like additional spending? Well, I like that program. Why don't we have that additional spending? You don't have to pay for it. And that's what happens. Now, fortunately, most of the tax cuts were because they couldn't afford them all and they phased them in and out expire at some time. And to get them reenacted and extended, you're going to have to start paying for them. And they can't do it. And so a lot of these, we will dig ourselves up just by the tax cuts expiring. We'll do a lot of it. Last year, the Congressional Black Caucus had a budget that balanced in the fifth year, primarily because we just repealed all of the tax cuts on that portion of your income over $200,000. And that generated enough money to not only, when the Republican budget was $163 billion in the ditch, the Congressional Black Caucus budget had a $2 billion surplus. We also had enough money left over to put about $80 billion in 5 years into education and job training, $20 billion more in health care, $20 billion more in veterans, and billions more in everything else you could imagine the Black Caucus would want to spend money on. Housing, social services, and everything else. And still, we're balanced just by repealing all of what they did for that portion of your income over $200,000. So it's there, but you can't have massive tax cuts like the $20 billion tax cut that people over $100,000 get almost 100% of it. People over $200,000, people over $1 million get half of it. You can't give away tax cuts like that to the wealthy and have enough money left over to fund Social Security. So you have to make a choice. If you want Social Security, you pay for it. And it's not that difficult. And the numbers, although we're at the point now where if we do something right now, we could save it. If you wait right up until the time, you haven't had time to save up enough money, compounding the interest, so you got something to work with. If you go right into 2017 broke, it's too late. It's over. I think you got another year or two to make a substantial improvement, and you can save Social Security. Now, Medicare is another problem. It's a more difficult problem. You're not going to be able to repeal anything. You got to get them when they expire. And then the question is going to be whether or not we have the political will on the Democratic side. I don't know. All the Republicans are going to be for it. There'll be enough Democrats that don't want to be tax and spend. It's going to be a close vote. Al? Well, the reentry programs include at least the last 6 months of imprisonment, if not a lot during prison. The Second Chance Act is one of the first things that we're going to be doing this year. We had good bipartisan support. As you've indicated, 70% of the people are coming back. You can do a lot about prison population just by doing something about that one. And we know what to do. Part of it, you have a choice. I said you have a choice, reduce crime or play politics. Several years ago, we considered legislation to prohibit prisoners from getting access to Pell Grants to go to college while they're in prison. Turns out those that took a Pell Grant, got a college education, were instead of 70% likely to come back, were more like 15%. Likely to come back. You add the reduced prison expenses compared to the increased Pell Grant expense, and you save more money than you spent. Except it's bad. So policy-wise, you know what to do. Politics, why should a prisoner get a Pell Grant when my child can't get a Pell Grant? And 2-1, Pell Grants for prisoners dissolved. And now they are unable to get Pell Grants, unable to go to college, more likely to come back. So we suffer more crime and spend more of the taxpayers' money because we made the wrong decision. But the Second Chance Act will give, and there's another, the Prison Industries Program. Significant reduction in crime for those that participate in the Prison Industries Program. We have been able to save the Prison Industries Program on very close votes. A couple of them in the Judiciary Committee were tie votes over an attacks because the contracts that prisoners are working on are contracts that somebody else could be working on. Now, if you add up all the contracts the prisoners are working on and what effect that has on an outside industry, it's negligible. I mean, you can't even measure it. You got 1 million-some people working in the industry and a few thousand working in prison industries. I mean, if they were working on the contract or not working on the contract, the 1 million people wouldn't notice it. But you could say, well, one prisoner is working here, and if one person is out of work, that could be, 10,000 people out of work and 300 people working in prison industries, all 10,000 think those 300 got their job. So the politics is you want to get rid of prison industries. Well, they almost did. It's surviving. It's been significantly cut. So, I mean, you get the politics and policy question in reentry. Hopefully we'll be able to get some significant resources. The Virginia program that's been very successful is Virginia Cares. Community action agencies run its community action reentry system or program, Virginia Cares, and they have shown real good success in reducing recidivism by working with prisoners before they get out. And then right after they get out, if you can get a prisoner into a job and hold the job for a few months, the chances are much less that they're coming back. If they get out and can't find a job, chances of they're coming back escalate. So the transition period is extremely important aspect of whether they're going to come back or not. And the second chance programs, the reentry programs, are extremely valuable in helping during that critical time. Tens of billions.
What I was wondering, there's been some proposals to not put people who are guilty of nonviolent crimes like drug offenses, not have to go to prison. What do you say about prisons doing that?
There are also some studies that show if you're a little more judicious in the use of imprisonment, that you could actually reduce the crime rate for nonviolent offenders. Many times a suspended sentence will produce a lower recidivism rate than actually locking somebody up. If you have someone who has made a mistake, a good prospect for parole, some studies have shown that keeping them on parole rather than locking them up creates a situation where they can keep their apartment, they can keep their job, and they're on the right track with some guidance. Compared to somebody that goes to jail for 6 months, when they get out, they don't have anywhere to live, they don't have a job, and they probably can't get a job because where have they been the last 6 months? Who wants to hire that? So if you look at two people, again, lock them up, throw away the key, be tough on crime, or good policy, which will actually produce the lower crime rate, We have not been judicious in our use of of incarceration, particularly for drug offenses. Locking somebody up because they're a drug user, drug courts, which give people intensive rehabilitation, compared to lock them up. Lock them up costs 5 times more, and at the end of the year, the one that was locked up is more likely to be back in trouble than the one who's in the drug court getting rehabilitation at 1/5 the cost. So you reduce crime and it costs you less. So, I mean, if it's policy, that's an easy question. If it's politics, what sounds better? Lock them up and throw away the key and my opponent's soft on crime, or good policy? I mean, we frequently have things to vote on where everybody knows it's stupid, but it's popular. How do you vote? Well, we have the highest incarceration rate anywhere in the world.